National History Day. Have you ever heard of it? Well, it's a competition for high schoolers and middle schoolers. And this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse, I'm very pleased to present to our listening audience three young people who did extremely well this past March in their History Day competition, which was held at Jim Thorpe High School. I'm John Pierce. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we're very pleased to have you listening in this evening. We have three guests, and the first of those is Jacob Roth. Jacob, your school, and what grade were you in when you did History Day?
I attended Parkland High School, and I recently completed my freshman year.
And your topic is the Freeze Rebellion. What is the Freeze Rebellion?
The Freeze Rebellion was a protest that occurred in 1799 to 1800, in which several farmers in Pennsylvania took a stand against the new tax that the federal government had imposed upon them, which taxed their houses and specifically the window sizes on their houses.
And there is another name for it besides the Freeze Rebellion. What's that?
It is called the Home Tax Rebellion.
And what were the years of that?
1799, actually, it really began in 1798, but the official rebellion started in 1799 and ended in 1800.
Mm-hmm. So what's the connection between John Freeze? First of all, who was John Freeze?
John Freeze was a farmer and auctioneer from southeastern Pennsylvania, and he was a descendant of German immigrants, and he is the one that led most of these protests.
So a farmer from Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. And what's his connection with John Adams?
Well, they were very different growing up. Adams was of a higher class. John Freeze grew up as a son of a farmer. So the reason that they are so similar is both of them, at certain points in their life, have taken a stand. John Adams took a stand during the American Revolution against the King of Great Britain, and John Freeze, in 1799 and 1800, took a stand against the federal government.
So they took stands against something, against authority.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good way to say it? Let me mention to our listeners that every year, National History Day presents a topic. And so this past year, Jacob, when you participated, the topic was?
Taking a stand.
Taking a stand in history. So some historical figure, such as John Freeze. Other typical themes that they come up with for History Day, turning points in history, debate and diplomacy in history. Actually, this topic of taking a stand in history was done, I see here, in 2006, as well as 2017. So sometimes they come back to conflict and compromise in history, geography in history, and so on, different mm-hmm. topics. And this was taking a stand in history. How did you first get interested in this whole home tax rebellion?
Well, when I first saw the theme, I knew that I wanted to do something that relates to a local historical situation, something that maybe not many people know about. Obviously, with taking a stand, you have the Civil Rights Act, the Emancipation Proclamation, or the Women's Rights Movement. But I wanted something that is not as well known, and I wanted to be able to do research on that. That way I would be able to help other people learn more about it.
Very good. And it is a rebellion that took place in Pennsylvania. Was it entirely in Pennsylvania?
It was entirely in Pennsylvania.
Okay. Yeah. And kind of in our neck of the woods, too.
Yeah, right down the road in McCungee and here in Bethlehem and up in Northampton County. So it's very interesting.
Very
it's
close.
Local.
So how does the Freeze Rebellion have an impact on our nation's history?
It was, in 1799 and 1800, the United States of America was still a very young government. So this was one of the first times that there was a large group of people protesting against the national government. Obviously, in the years since then, we've seen that, but this was the first major protest against a federal law and against a president.
And in order to write your paper, now you wrote, what were the constraints of the paper?
The paper had to be between 1,500 and 2,500 words, and it had to follow a certain format of with in-text citations and a proper bibliography at the end. And those were the limits. I mean, everything inside of it, you know, you had to draw certain conclusions, but it was up to the author to write the paper and present the topic.
And to let the listeners know, the paper's length turns out to be roughly 7 pages.
Yeah, that's correct.
When you get those words in there. And you used 8 primary sources and 5 secondary sources. Mm-hmm. So you had to learn about that along the way, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you know already about primary and secondary sources?
I did. This is the 3rd year that I've done History Day. So by now, I've gotten familiar with both primary and secondary sources. And I really like to use a majority of primary sources because those are sources written by people who actually experienced the event.
Exactly.
And I think that's important to have that firsthand account.
Right. You participated then 2 years ago in History Day, where the topic was leadership and legacy in mm-hmm. history. And last year it was exploration, encounter, and exchange in history.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's taking a stand in history this year. Where did you find your resources? How did you go about that?
Well, I found a lot of great books and websites. The one book was actually published at the University of Pennsylvania. It was all about the Freeze Rebellion. The National Archives also has a great collection of letters and the actual presidential pardon. I found that in the archives. So really, when you go to the National Archives and other databases, there's an unlimited amount of sources, even on topics such as this.
What did you find the most interesting about the Freeze Rebellion once you'd studied this whole?
What I really found interesting was the extent to which they rebelled. This was not a peaceful march down Main Street. This was a rough and violent rebellion. The protesters chased the tax assessors out of town on horseback. Actually, the wives of several of the men who owned the houses would pour scalding hot water from the second story onto the tax assessors when they would come to survey and assess their house.
Ouch. This,
yeah, it was not pretty, but it definitely has some historical significance for
They
for
got across
violent.
Their point that they didn't want these assessors coming through town.
They had a very interesting way of doing that, but yes, they did.
You mentioned this was a local event, so give us a little of the geography.
Well, most of the rebellion happened in Macungie and around Quakertown. Actually, right over here in Bethlehem on Main Street, the Sun Tavern, which is now called the Sun Inn, is where many of the rebels surrounded the Sun Inn and forced some of the leaders to come out and talk to them. And that was basically a meeting place for both members who were representing the government and also for the rebels. So it ties into Bethlehem and Macungie and Northampton. So it's
I think it's fantastic that the Sun Inn is still going, a going concern. It's had its ups and downs through the years.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard recently, go there to have a meal. It is a fantastic place. And when you're interested in history, it's even better.
We're very blessed to live in an area where there's so much history around us. Yeah,
exactly. Tell us a little bit. This is your 3rd History Day. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to the next one next year?
Oh, very much.
Okay. Do we know the topic yet?
I do not know the theme for next year, but I'm excited to find that out so I can start researching. And
I'll see if I can find it somewhere. What is your experience in the other 2 years with History Day?
The other 2 years, last year I had the honor of going all the way to the national competition with my paper, and that was a great experience. It's held for 1 week in the middle of June at the University of Maryland in College Park, Maryland, and that was a great experience. I got to meet great people from all over the country and from abroad. Many of the History Day participants also come from Asia, from the South Pacific Islands. So that was a great experience.
Congratulations. Yes.
Thank you.
Because
Thank
what
you.
You have participated in this year that we're talking about at Jim Thorpe High School is regional.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, do you go to state?
The state
after
competition.
That?
Yes.
And is that in Harrisburg?
This year it's in Carlisle. Pennsylvania.
Not far.
Yeah, not far from Pittsburgh.
And then from there to national.
To national.
If you make it that far.
Yes.
Well, that's fantastic that you made it that far. If you have your paper there, would you give us a little flavor of your writing? I want to go to the very last paragraph. And this is Jacob Roth's writing as he ends his paper for History Day.
The Home Tax Rebellion of 1799 to 1800 stands in the imprint of American history because it paved the way for other people associated with movements to take a stand against laws that they deemed to be unjust and unconstitutional. But even more significantly, it set a precedent for future leaders by serving as an example of how authority figures in the federal government would respond to protests. John Adams, when pardoning the rebels, looked to his experience in the American Revolution and drew a similarity between the rebels and the patriots. He pardoned them, the rebels, because he understood the great American idea that those who stand up for what they believe in is right will bring the change necessary to build a stronger United States of America.
Where he could have very well wanted to squelch any kind of dissent.
Absolutely. I believe that he did when he first heard of this case, but after thinking about it, after pulling from his own experiences, he changed his mind and set a precedent.
Well, this is really an interesting topic, and I thank you for bringing it to the attention of our listeners. As I told you off the air, I do not remember having studied this in school, though it may have come across the radar at some point, but I certainly had forgotten it. So this is The Home Tax Rebellion of 1799-1800, or the Freeze Rebellion, named after John Freeze. Now, I found out, Jacob, that you are also very interested in music.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you play a couple of instruments. Mm-hmm. What are they?
I play the piano and the organ, and I also used to play trumpet, but now I've narrowed it down to the keyboard instruments because that's what I really enjoy, and that's what I hope to do in the future.
And so you see music in your future?
I see music in my future, yes.
Mm-hmm. And possibly history as well?
Yes, I'd like to think of music as a hobby that I will always have, but I think history and politics and government is definitely the field that I wish to study in and pursue as a career.
So this is Jacob Roth, who has just completed which
ninth
grade?
Ninth grade
at Parkland High School. And participated in National History Day this past March, writing about the Home Tax Rebellion, or as we call it, the Freeze Rebellion. Jacob, let's give a little shout out to the teacher who was involved with getting you into this history
yes.
day.
I always want to thank my social studies teacher, Ms. Calliope Velikas from Parkland High School. She has been a great coordinator for the History Day Club, and I know all the students from Parkland High School appreciate her hard work and dedication.
Do you know if there were others from Parkland who participated this year?
Yes, there were. There were a total of 9 students, I believe, that are moving on to the state competition.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Not all of them writing papers, though.
No, History Day has several different categories. Besides the paper, there's also the documentary category, the website category, the drama category, where students write a script and then perform their own skit. And there is also a display board category.
And you happen to choose writing the paper.
Mm-hmm. That is correct.
All right. Now, what do you have? What are you looking forward to this summer?
This summer, I'm looking forward to being able to relax, take some time. In terms of history, definitely finding out the theme for next year, and maybe finding a topic for my paper next year.
Okay, and you're going to be doing some music, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely.
In the summertime?
Absolutely.
Is there any kind of a combo or an orchestra that you participate in?
I play for the chorus during the school year, but during the summer I usually play either on my own. Since I am involved with the piano and the organ, I often play at local churches and local community events.
Mm-hmm. So let's... let's mention also 2 very important people in your life, your parents.
Mm-hmm. My parents, Jennifer and Michael Roth. I just want to thank them for all of their hard work and for driving me to interviews and to the History Day competitions, and I couldn't have done it without them.
Are you thinking already about colleges?
I am, actually. I've started to think of a few names of certain colleges that I'd like, you know, possibly attend.
Right, and you're just you're about 3 years away from actually going to college.
Yeah, about 3 years.
So this is a little bit early to be asking you that, but it's good for you to be thinking ahead, certainly. Even though historians think it's very cool for us to be thinking backwards.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the great things about history is if you look backwards, if you look in the past, it can help you formulate your ideas and your goals for the future, things you want to change, ways of going about that have worked in the past. So I think looking at history can help us prepare for the future.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Sometimes I ask the question, why are we so fascinated with history? It's all done and gone. It's in the past. And yet it helps us figure out who we are and what our context is. And it does turn out to be really interesting, as you have shown with your history paper on John Freeze and the rebellion. It was a farmer's rebellion.
It was a farmer's rebellion. John Freeze, he had some experience in farming. His main occupation, he was actually an auctioneer. So he often worked with the farmers. And so he came from a middle-class family, and he definitely made a name for himself and accomplish some of his goals.
All right. Well, we have brought his name to the fore now for our listeners. And Jacob, I thank you very much for coming over. This is your first time at WDIY.
This is my first time at WDIY.
Congratulations. You survived to tell about it.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure to have you come over and chat with me now on Lehigh Valley Discourse. It's time for us to take a break. So for our listeners, we are moving from the early 19th century into the late 19th century for our next segment, and we will be back in 60 seconds.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Every year, National History Day frames students' research within a historical theme. The theme is chosen for the broad application to world, national, or state history, and its relevance to ancient history or to the more recent past. This year's theme was Taking a Stand in History, and my guest now on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Caitlin Fitzgerald. Caitlin, you chose as your theme?
My theme was Susan B. Anthony.
Susan B. Anthony. Now, that's a name that is familiar to most of us, I would say. But we don't know really that many details, and that's where you're going to help us right now on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Caitlin, when you participated in History Day in March, you were what grade and what school?
I'm in 10th grade, and I'm from Emmaus High School.
Very good. Let's give a shout out to the teacher who encouraged you for History Day.
Well, actually, my American Studies teacher from last year, Mr. Corolla, encouraged me to do History Day last year. And so I was inspired again to do it this year.
All right, so yeah. You participated twice now.
Yes.
And tell us about the first time you participated. It was not with a paper, was it?
No, it was with a documentary about Dorothea Dix.
And so you had to make up a documentary with other students as a team?
Yeah.
And this time you did it on your own. The paper is just yours, correct?
Right.
Okay. So we're talking about Susan B. Anthony. Do you remember how many primary and secondary sources you used?
I think I used around maybe 13 total. I think I used around 4 primary sources, which were all speeches of hers from various points in her life.
And we're going to hear one of those speeches in a few minutes from Susan B. Anthony, and then the other were secondary sources. So let's start off with asking you why you happened to choose Susan B. Anthony as the focus of your paper. There are other leaders in women's rights,
but you chose
her.
Well, I just think she really stood out to me as a very prominent member of the women's suffrage movement, especially looking at the theme of History Day with taking a stand. I thought that the fact that she had voted illegally in the 1872 election, it made her stand out because she did a specific act of standing up that she really wasn't supposed to do. And so I really thought that that single action of voting just made her stand above the rest.
All right. And that election of 1872 was Ulysses S. Grant winning for re-election. He had already been president. And I found that he defeated Thomas A. Hendricks. I never heard of him, but I've heard of U.S. Grant. And so Grant was the Republican, and Hendricks was the Independent Democrat. So 1872. How do you think Susan B. Anthony even made it into the polling place? She's a woman.
Well, actually, her and two of her sisters went, and they talked their way in by talking to the people who were judges in a way. They were kind of there to stop people from registering who weren't qualified. And they actually talked their way in by arguing that the 15th Amendment actually allowed them to vote. And I don't know if maybe some of the judges saw that, oh, they might be voting for Grant and I want Grant to win. So maybe they had a little bit of influence there that let them kind of go through.
Impartial pollsters.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's interesting. And so they were by force of their dialogue with these people, they convinced the people that they ought to be able to vote. But the 15th Amendment does not give women the right to vote.
That's right.
What was their argument?
Well, there was a bit of a gray area there because the 15th Amendment kind of outlined the rights of citizens. It made the African Americans who were slaves who had been freed by the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment, it made them citizens. And so it also said that state and federal laws such as the right to vote could not be discriminated with on the basis of race. And so even though the word sex was not included in that, Susan B. Anthony and her sisters did argue that because they were citizens of the United States, they had that right to vote that couldn't be intervened with.
Okay, and so that 15th Amendment really gives African-American men the right to vote.
Right.
Not the women. So no woman could vote before what year?
Before 1920 with the 19th Amendment.
Okay. And then it was open to women even. 1920. What made Susan B. Anthony focus more on women's suffrage rather than the temperance movement? Ooh, she had previously been involved in that too.
Yeah, she had been. That was her original. That was kind of her entering activism. She was involved in the temperance movement, but she actually found that there was discrimination against women within that movement. She wasn't allowed to speak at a meeting of the temperance movement members. She was, when she stood up to speak, she was told to sit down and that women were only there to listen. And that kind of made her realize that even within these other activist type movements, she, like, women were still being discriminated against. So I think that made her realize how big of an issue there was. So she left that movement and focused more on women's suffrage.
Yeah, being told to sit down and be quiet probably made her blood boil, do you suppose?
Yeah.
Why is she more important than her sisters? I didn't even know that she had sisters involved in this.
Well, movement. I haven't really heard of her sisters either, except that they went to vote with her, so I don't really think they were involved much.
Okay, they were not as involved. And she was, Susan B. Anthony was quite an orator.
Yes, she
so
was.
So that would convince people when she made a speech or when she, even when she talked to the pollsters.
Mm-hmm.
They let her in. What was her greatest contribution to the women's rights movement, would you say?
I would say after she voted, when she was arrested for voting, I think a few days later, she went to court and she spoke very well for her point of view with the 15th Amendment and just for the women's suffrage movement and the women's rights movement in general. I think that even though she lost in her case, she really got word out there about her cause, because it could have been really ignored earlier, but she was, by like speaking in court, she was really putting it before the public to think about. So I think that kind of caused an important turning point in the movement. It kind of propelled it a little bit.
And I'd like for you to read some of the words of Susan B. Anthony. I'm looking on page 6 of your paper, where you quote one of her speeches. And just give us a little taste of the oratory of Susan B. Anthony.
Okay. In your ordered verdict of guilty, you've trampled underfoot every vital principle of our government. My natural rights, my civil rights, my political rights are all alike ignored. Robbed of the fundamental privilege of citizenship, I am degraded from the status of a citizen to that of a subject. And not only myself individually, but all of my sex are, by your honor's verdict, doomed to political subjection under this so-called Republican government.
Right, and she was accused of voting, is that all?
Yeah, voting when she was not permitted to vote in
okay.
a federal election.
Well, the way that I ask the question divulges that I'm 21st century, right? I can't
yeah.
believe that women would not be able to vote. But we're coming up pretty soon on the 100th anniversary of women's vote. Women's
mm-hmm.
suffrage here in the U.S. Susan B. Anthony struck up a friendship with Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Now, her name is less known probably than Susan B. Anthony, but still pretty outstanding. They combined their talents, which were different, and were able to make a big impact and head toward what we now know as women's suffrage, which finally was passed in the early 20th century. What sacrifices did Susan B. Anthony make in order to achieve her goal of women's suffrage?
I think that she made a lot of personal sacrifice. She really just devoted her whole life to her goal of women's suffrage. So she didn't really involve herself in much else besides the women's suffrage effort.
All right, and also you mentioned before the temperance movement.
Yeah.
Now, once she really became interested in, with that election of 1872 and she voted illegally, did she turn away from temperance as a focus and really start to do only women's suffrage?
Yeah, I would say even before that she did, and she was also involved in the abolition movement, which she parted from due to controversy about her view of the 15th Amendment.
All right, so at least three different really large areas that she
yeah.
was involved in. How did Anthony and Stanton cause friction between the women's rights and abolitionist movements?
Well, they were both involved in the abolition movement, kind of like I mentioned earlier, and when the 15th Amendment came about and people were hearing about it, they were outraged because it didn't include women. So it would further allow discrimination of women in voting. But the abolitionists wanted that amendment because for African Americans to vote was a huge deal. So there was some issues there with other people from the women's suffrage movement who were also in the abolition movement. And it actually caused the women's suffrage movement to split into two groups. And Anthony and Stanton led the more radical group. They didn't want to wait for another amendment. They wanted to change the 15th Amendment. While the other group, which was led by Lucy Stone, decided that they could wait and just let the 15th Amendment go through as is.
So what you're saying is that during the time that the states were voting on the 15th Amendment, that's the time that these women were trying to decide, do we want to have women included in suffrage or let it go and have that be part of the past and then in the future have another amendment, correct?
Yeah.
And that future amendment turned out to be the 19th.
Right.
And that was 1920. How did Anthony's experience in court affect her efforts in the women's suffrage movement?
Well, her speaking in court was very motivational to many people in the women's suffrage movement, and even her losing the case and being fined, it motivated her further to keep fighting and traveling the country with giving speeches, and it kind of gave her a push that made her realize that it wasn't as easy as just arguing in court. Like, she would have to do more than that.
Yeah, though she was quite an orator, and I imagine very effective. Oh, I'd love to. Did you ever hear any kind of a recording of her giving a speech?
I have not. I think it's a bit early.
It's too early for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be fantastic to have that as part of the record. That would have been a primary source for you, right?
Definitely.
Why was Anthony significant in the 2016 election? We're talking almost 100 years after the suffrage movement was finished and the 19th Amendment was passed.
Right. Even though she was significant in every election following the passage of the 19th Amendment, just because she helped fight for the right of women to vote, she was especially important in this past election because of Hillary Clinton, the first female major party candidate running. It inspired many women to actually take their I voted stickers and go to her grave in New York, and they actually stuck it on her grave to kind of show that appreciation and to appreciate how far, like, America has come with women's rights.
And you actually provide a picture of that grave stone in your paper that I have in my hand right here. And it's little stickers pretty much covering the whole gravestone.
Right.
And I think that would really have pleased Susan B. Anthony if she's looking from on high at this whole experience we have in the 21st century. Susan B. Anthony, this is part of what you write. She recognized that women could not achieve equal rights until they achieved economic independence and the education they needed for such independence. So that was an important piece of her thinking. A very interesting topic that you chose for your History Day paper. Again, this is Caitlin Fitzgerald, and she wrote her History Day paper on Susan B. Anthony. And you're very interested, obviously, in women's rights and the right to vote, mm-hmm. which we sort of take for granted now, don't we? And the rest of us take for granted. Just voting in general. It's just part of our scene nowadays, and we should not take it for granted. Caitlin, thank you so much for coming over to WDIY. Your first time here?
Yeah.
Let's give a shout out to two important people in your life.
Oh, yeah. My parents.
And what are their names?
Kent and Gretchen Fitzgerald.
Right.
Yeah.
And thanks to them for the encouragement they've given you with your education.
Yeah, definitely.
We are moving along here with Lehigh Valley Discourse. We are coming up to the 20th century. And we'll be back after this break and talk about World War II era. Stay with us. Back in 60 seconds.
In 2017, WDIY is celebrating 22 years on the air. If you listen to WDIY, support the station by becoming a member today. Members are our most reliable source of support. We couldn't be here without you. To become a member, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100. WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley and beyond.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
National History Day. This year's theme, as we've said, is taking a stand in history. The intentional selection of the theme for National History Day is to provide an opportunity for students to push past the antiquated view of history as mere facts and dates. So many of us studied history thinking that that's what it was. It was the dates of battles, the dates that kings were on the throne, and that presidents were in office in our country, and so on. And so these students are encouraged to drill down into historical content to develop perspective and understanding. That sounds like a whole lot on your plate, Prathisha.
No, it was a very exciting experience just to be able to really dig into a specific area of history. So.
You're listening to Prathisha Kothari, who is one of the contestants at History Day this year. She wrote a paper, and we're going to get to that in just a minute. Prathisha, first, your school and your grade when you participated in
History Day. When I participated in History Day, I was in eighth grade at Orfield Middle School in the Parkland School District.
Very good. And who was the teacher who encouraged you to for History Day?
My advisor was Mrs. Miller. She's an eighth grade civics teacher, so.
Very good. Was this your first History Day experience?
This was my first History Day experience writing a paper. Last year I competed as well, but I made an exhibit, so a little bit different.
Yes, very different. The different activities that you must choose among, the paper, posters.
The exhibit, you're right.
Exhibit?
Mm-hmm.
You can put on a performance?
Yep, a documentary and a website.
Okay, so those are the categories, and you chose this year a paper. If you participate next year, do you think you'd choose a paper again, or would you go for another?
I think so. I think I love writing. I think it just suits me well. I'm not very good with that technology stuff, so I think this is a good fit.
Thank you for saying that. You're so young, and I feel kind of flabbergasted with technology.
Oh, yeah, you and me both.
Good. Now, in this paper that you wrote, Your topic is?
Oscar Schindler.
Ooh, we're talking World War II, huh?
Yes.
And what's the subtitle of your paper?
The subtitle is How a Nazi, How His Discreet Defiance and Humanitarian Efforts Saved Thousands of Jews During World War II.
Okay. We're talking about a Nazi who saved thousands of Jews.
Yeah.
No wonder this is an interesting topic.
Thanks.
Most people have heard only of Oscar Schindler because of the award-winning movie Schindler's List, which came out in 1993. Can you tell us more about, I'm sure you can tell us more about who Schindler was, because this is your paper.
Of course. Well, like you said before, we have to put Schindler into context with World War II to really try to understand, you know, his paradoxical character, being a Nazi who saved Jews, his childhood influences, and most of all, his motives to save Jews. So Schindler was born in Czechoslovakia and lived a comfortable, carefree life with his as the son of a farming businessman, and was always known for his adventurous and daring nature. Though he went to engineering school, he soon abandoned his studies and instead began to follow the industrial footsteps of his father. His unique charisma, strong presence, and persuasion skills made him an immediate success among powerful businessmen. And following the Depression, he actually enlisted as a Nazi, but was never really involved in the group's efforts and primarily only used the title to increase his business allure. Schindler was drawn to money and women and the risky pleasures of life, and even at one point worked for a German secret service agency. Later in 1938, he moved to Krakow, Poland to seek business opportunities and ended up buying an enamelware factory that had been taken from its previous Jewish owner. He started this business only for profit, no question about it, but he quickly hired 150 workers, only seven of which were Jews. Schindler began his humanitarian initiatives once he realized the tortures that his Jews were being subject to in his factory. But even before the war, Oscar never really had any strong prejudices against anyone of different faiths and was not very religious himself. He grew up with Jewish friends and went to college with two close Jewish neighbors. And later when he moved to Poland, he became very close associates with two Jewish accountants who helped him manage his factory. So in summary, Schindler used his various unique characteristics to save Jews right beneath the Nazis' noses. He had to act daily and played an incredibly dangerous part. And I think, as I quote in my paper, Schindler was an angel masked as a sinner in a sea of Nazis and wrongdoers.
So. Say that one again.
Yes. So he was an angel masked as a sinner in a sea of demons.
And he was playing along as if he were one of the persecutors.
Yes.
And then he looked for ways to help people who were going to be executed eventually.
Yeah, it's a very, very tricky position to be in.
Exactly. How did his morals and value system change as the war went on?
So in the beginning, Schindler was all about money. And like I said before, I think some history books even call him the aficionado of the three W's, women, wealth, and whiskey. He always sought personal gain, but as the war progressed, he really started to realize more important aspects of life. In particular, he understood that he valued family life and comfort that he never had as a young child through his bonds with his workers. He came to understand how being happy, even in dire situations, can be the most important aspect of survival. And for this reason, he would always inculcate hope and compliment and engage with his workers in order to keep them alive. He put others for himself, and he also gained a really strong sense of humility. He didn't do it for himself. He was not blinded like the rest of the Aryans in Europe. He held firm and strengthened his belief in human equality and took every risk possible and sacrifice to save his workers.
Right. Now, could you describe any key pivoting moments in Schindler's life that led him into his humanitarian stand?
Yeah. So I think that's always the mystery, right? It's really hard to pinpoint exactly what events led to Schindler's, drastic change of heart. And to this day, historians really don't know and can only speculate as to why he decided to take his stand. However, they do define a few key turning points in his stand, one of them being a Nazi action in the Krakow ghetto of June 1942. During this event, over 1,000 Jews were killed, and absolute chaos and panic erupted during the event. Schindler, who happened to be witnessing such an atrocity, said afterwards that he was now vowed to defeat the system being obviously the Third Reich. Now, personally, I believe that Schindler's humanitarian character grew progressively throughout the war. As the intensity and infliction of pain upon the Jewish community grew right there within his factory. Like I said, he never had any religious prejudices, and through his inner circle with these Nazis and their plotting and scheming, he realized their twisted belief of Jewish inferiority and developed a disguised revulsion toward the Third Reich. He began with small actions like warning his accountant of a Nazi action, paying a Jewish family for housing, and eventually grew into more impactful and dangerous efforts.
I think that his attitude of accepting Jews not as the enemy but as other people who happened to be different from him was influenced by the fact that he was in close contact with some of them.
Yes,
he had neighbors. When he went to school, there were some Jewish students alongside of him. And I think the closer you get to people as individuals, the better you see their group as a whole.
Yes. Yeah. A large population just heard of Jews being monsters through all this different propaganda. But by being directly in contact with them and learning about their lives and realizing that they're really not that different, we are all the same, I think that also helped in developing Schindler's stand and character.
Three of his most important stands throughout the war.
Yes. So I'm going to try to go in chronological order here. But in the beginning, when Schindler first established his factory, he wanted to keep his workers from the Krakow ghetto and all that disease and sickness and illness there. So he built his own barracks on the factory grounds to keep his workers overnight. He made the excuse that this was in order to increase their productivity. But really, this effort ended up saving 400 Jews from an overnight liquidation. Now, this initial housing eventually inspired his establishment of a subcamp in his factory to keep his workers safe from the savagery in the work camps and the ghettos. Now, later in the winter of 1944, so approaching the end of the war, a frozen transport, like cattle cars full of Jews, was abandoned near his factory with 120 trapped people inside. Upon hearing about this, Schindler went with some of his workers to free the trapped Jews. They had to melt the doors open, and they discovered these frostbitten, sick, and skeletal victims. Schindler ushered them all into his factory and had to pay 600 marks a day to keep them as valuable workers when really he was just making sure that they recuperated. Now, as for the 20 who died in that transport, he made sure to conduct proper Jewish burials for them, so he respected their religion. And now, obviously, we come to the famous Schindler's List that everybody talks about. So in 1944, both the Plaszow work camp and Schindler's adjacent factory had to be dissolved due to the imminent Soviet invasion. But Schindler didn't want to abandon his Jews and just condemn them to the crematoria and extermination camp. So he developed this list, recalling nearly 1,200 workers from memory to include to be taken to the factory. He asked workers for other Jews in the nearby community and from other factories to be put on the list. And he even went to the final list manager, Marshall Goldberg, and bribed him to ensure that all names would remain on his list that he made. He had to falsify ages and skills to make his workers within the Nazi expectations for skilled workers. So though this went successfully, he met kind of a big bump on the road on the trip to the new factory in Brinlitz. So during this event, the 300 women who were from his factory, their train was diverted to the Auschwitz extermination camp for 3 weeks. When Schindler heard about this, he went right to the camp and succeeded in bribing one of the officials there and brought nearly all of those 300 workers back to Brinlitz.
And they were all women.
They were all women. So I think one of the, like, this is an incredible and monumental accomplishment. And one of his survivors actually famously quotes, "Can you imagine what power it took for Schindler to pull 300 people from Auschwitz? At Auschwitz, there was only one way out, we said, through the chimney. Yet Schindler got 300 out alive."
Wow. So. Yes, what a feat.
Yes.
And so Schindler's List is 1,200 names?
1,200, around that, yeah.
And they are people that Schindler claimed he needed for workers.
Yes.
And so he would falsify whatever he had to get them to go with him,
right,
and not go to extermination camps.
Yeah.
Well, obviously his deeds impacted those individuals. What about their descendants?
Right. So Schindler's descendants, he certainly had an impact that extended for generations. And today there are over 8,500 living descendants of the original Schindler's Jews. In their new lives, these survivors made valuable community contributions of their own. One of them, Leon Lason, who was just a boy during the war, moved to America and published an award-winning novel called The Boy on the Wooden Box, which conveyed his war experience and how Schindler impacted his life during the war.
What was the name of that book again?
The Boy on the Wooden Box. Yes. One of his other survivors, Poldek Pfefferberg, who was actually Schindler's black marketer, collaborated with Thomas Keneally on his novel Schindler's List, which later became an Oscar-winning film, as we said. Another survivor, Murray Pantier, named several streets after Schindler in his community construction project and even became a founding member of the Holocaust Museum. His Schindler's, you know, all his survivors all stayed with Schindler throughout his life, always invited him to their life events. And in 1962, to honor him, the group Yad Vashem, which was a Jewish organization in Jerusalem, awarded him the title of Righteous Gentile. So that was a big honor.
And in this point in his life, is it after World War II?
This is afterwards, yes.
And where did he live at that point?
Yeah, so Schindler's post-war life was very paradoxical and honestly unexpected. After the liberation of the Jews and the end of the war, Schindler became a target enemy at the Nazi as a Nazi, so he had to flee to Argentina. But he soon returned home to Frankfurt, and though he tried to start up new business ventures, he did not succeed in them. And after devoting over, I think, 4 million German marks to his saving initiative, he was also destitute. Like I mentioned, since most of his Schindler's Jews traveled around the world to other countries, he was more alone than ever, and his own peers as Germans knew of his efforts and his love for Jews and scorned him for that. But the only bright spot really were his Jews, who not only supported him monetarily, but they also invited him around the world, like I said, to attend their life events. I think, like I touch on in my paper, in a sense, it's as if Schindler switched places with his Jews after the war. So it's very interesting and unexpected turn for him after the war, I think.
Now, Schindler was not the only non-Jewish person to help Jews during World War II.
Right.
And during all this persecution. So why do you believe that Oskar Schindler is unique amongst these people?
Right. So I think it's really Schindler's position. Like we said, he was a Nazi. So every day he would have to associate with these other Nazi officials and pretend to believe in all the malice and hatred they wanted to inflict. But Schindler also knew the Jews themselves and saw how good these people were, how true and honest, and that they were not at all the monsters that they were made to be. So this put him in a very difficult position. He was always under scrutiny in his factory. Inspections always came from the Nazis to make sure his workers were up to par and to make sure, you know, everything was going well. But Schindler had vowed that he would never have, that he would prohibit violence in his factory. So carrying that out was a big, you know, thing that could have arose suspicion on numerous occasions. So he was just, I mean, it's incredible that he was able to save all those Jews. And that's why to this day, we have a lot to learn from him.
He's so well known, yes.
Yes, yeah.
So my guest now is Prithisha Kothari, and she has written her history paper on Oscar Schindler. To finish up our interview, I'd like for you to read the conclusion of your paper.
Of course. So, a scoundrel, maverick, industrialist, Nazi, and saint. Though we may never comprehend the true motive behind Schindler's discreet and progressive defiance, it's obvious that his efforts to save thousands of Jews serve as a paragon of justice. As he claimed himself after the war, a thinking man who had overcome his cowardice simply had to help. Schindler was beautiful and ambiguous in his humanitarian actions, and because of that, he will forever enchant mankind. Through his innumerable efforts to thwart Nazi sadism, eradicate prejudice, and rescue over 1,200 lives, Oscar remained humble and accepted his inglorious post-war life since it entailed his Jews' survival. Especially today, as the threat of ethnic persecution may resurface, we must embody Schindler's stand and find the courage to defend human equality. In his simple words, Schindler expressed, "I hated the brutality, the sadism, and insanity of Nazism. I couldn't just stand by and see people being destroyed. I did what I could and what my conscience told me I must do. That's all there is to it."
Prithisha Kothari, very well done.
Thank you
for coming
much.
Over and chatting with us on Lehigh Valley Discourse.
It was a pleasure.
Just a shout out to two people who are important in your life.
Oh, yes. To my mom, who helps me every day and supports me in everything to do, and my dad, who always knows just how to make me laugh. So
wonderful. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to Lehigh Valley Discourse. This wraps it for another edition. Thanks to Neil Heaver, our engineer this evening. He's our director of operations here at WDIY. I'm John Pierce, your host. And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.